Welcome to the Tax Institute's new monthly series, Tax Insights. Each month, you will be hearing from Senior Advocate of the Tax Institute, Robin Jacobson, taking you through the key matters that the Tax Policy and Advocacy team have in their sights. Here's Robin to explain more.
Welcome to our monthly tax series, Tax Insights. I'm Robin Jacobson, the Senior Advocate at the Tax Institute. Each month, I shall be discussing the key matters that are in our sights at the Tax Institute's Tax Policy and Advocacy team. This presentation draws content from the monthly tax update materials, and page references are shown on each slide. This month, I shall be discussing a legislative update. There is a key bill sitting before Parliament at the moment, the Victorian Windfall Gains Tax Measure. We're going to have a look at a recent High Court decision, the Addy case, which deals with the backpacker tax. We'll look at an update on working from home, which was touched on last month, but we've now got some formal guidance from the ATO. So let's begin with a legislative update. There is a bill sitting before the House of Representatives. It's quite a mouthful. The Treasury Laws Amendment, Enhancing Superannuation Outcomes for Australians and Helping Australian Business Invest, Bill of 2021. There are six schedules in this bill, each of which are of interest to us. So we'll start with Schedule 1, which draws on a budget announcement from earlier this year, where the government announced that they would remove the monthly income threshold of $450, which currently and has applied for some time in the superannuation guarantee legislation. Now, the point of removing this particular threshold, and this will be proposed from 1 July 2022, is that it means people who earn less than $450 a month, who currently do not receive employer superannuation support, will now indeed receive that support. If we think back to the old days of paying superannuation contributions by cheque, it was manual, it was tedious, and it was quite laborious when it came to paying very small amounts. But in this modern electronic and digital age, we've got Superstream in the back office, we've got single touch payroll. There's really no reason at a policy level why lower income earners should not benefit from employer contributions the same way that higher income earners do. So this is a good measure. It's expected to benefit around 300,000 individuals, 63% of whom are women. So there's no question that this is going to predominantly affect women who are usually the lower income earners in our community. But of course, anyone who is a low income earner is going to benefit from this. The measure is expected to apply from 1 July 2022. But if for any reason this bill is not enacted before then, and I would expect it would be, then the measure would actually start from the beginning of the first quarter after the bill receives royal assent. But that's only where that occurs for royal assent after 1 July 2022. Assuming royal assent is this side of 1 July 2022, it would take effect from that date. So will not apply for 21-22, we would expect it to take effect from 22-23 onwards. Schedule 3 to the bill relates to making downsizer contributions. Now, currently you need to be 65 years or older, and the proceeds from selling your home, so it's got to be eligible for the main residence exemption, and you must have had that property for at least 10 years, you may contribute those proceeds into your superannuation fund up to $300,000, and this does not count towards your non-concessional contributions cap. This particular measure is going to reduce that age limit. So instead of being 65 years or older, you'll be able to be 60 years or over to be able to make a downsizer contribution. This measure is expected to commence from 1 July 2022. Schedule 4 to the bill relates to the work test. Now, the work test is a current requirement for people aged 67 to 74, where in order to make certain contributions to their super fund, they have to satisfy the work test. And that means they need to be gainfully employed, basically working a certain number of hours in a certain time frame. Now, this, of course, is prohibitive for people being able to make contributions to their super fund. So Schedule 4 to the bill is going to repeal the work test for making non-concessional contributions and salary sacrifice contributions through the employer for those aged 67 to 74 from the 1st of July 2022. Notably, if you are that age, so 67 to 74, and you wish to make a personal deductible contribution, the work test will remain. So the work test is only being repealed for non-concessional contributions and salary sacrifice contributions. Schedule 5 to the bill relates to those who are calculating their exempt current pension income, of course, to determine how much tax is payable by a superannuation fund that has one or more members in retirement phase. Now, currently, if you have a fund with members who are in accumulation phase and there may be a separate member who is in pension phase, they may be required to use both the proportionate method and the segregated method in order to calculate their exempt current pension income. Now, this occurs where some but not all members are receiving a pension during the income year, and the remaining accumulation member begins to draw a pension during the year. And you've also got, for the period where only pensions are being paid, so let's say the latter half of the year when everybody's in pension phase, all the fund assets are segregated current pension assets. And this means that, for example, the fund has no unallocated reserves. Now, the purpose of this amendment is to deal with this circumstance. You will be able to choose to treat your assets as not being segregated current pension assets. So this means that the fund would be able to use the proportionate method when calculating their exempt current pension income for the whole income year, rather than being forced to use firstly the proportionate method and then the segregated method. Now, allowing trustees this choice is going to ultimately reduce compliance costs and also reduce the complexity for trustees. This is going to take effect from the 21-22 income year. So in other words, from 1 July 2021. And finally, Schedule 6 to the bill, totally unrelated to the superannuation measures that we've already covered. This relates to the temporary full expensing measure, which, as you will recall, replaced effectively the instant asset write-off, or at least temporarily, is the principal measure we use for small business entities and larger entities below $5 billion of aggregated turnover to be able to fully expense their depreciating assets. Now, what you're looking at here is a slide that you may well have seen many times before in different presentations, but I've repurposed it here, and it sets out for you, going all the way back to 2015, the instant asset write-off or the temporary full expensing measure that is available for business entities. Now, you'll see, of course, it's broken into the different sizes. So you've got small business entities under $10 million of aggregated turnover. We've then got the medium businesses from 10 million to less than 50 million. The medium to large businesses from 50 million to less than 500 million turnover. And then finally, the very large businesses where the temporary full expensing measure allows businesses below $5 billion of aggregated turnover to be able to fully expense their depreciating assets. Now, you also need to be very careful with all these rules because they're spread across a number of different provisions, both in the 97 Tax Act and also the Income Tax Transitional Provisions Act. The temporary full expensing measure is in the Income Tax Transitional Provisions Act of 1997, and you'll find it in subdivision 40BB. Now, when the measure was first announced, it was going to conclude at the end of 2022, that is June of next year. But in this year's budget, the government announced that they would extend it for a further 12 months. So the purpose of Schedule 6 to this bill is to simply extend the temporary full expensing measure for another 12 months to June of 2023. Any business that has an aggregated turnover of $10 million or more will not be able to fully expense any assets from 1 July 2023. Small business entities, however, will still have the current provision, which is 328.180, and that allows them to fully expense an asset that is under $1,000. Now, that rule is temporarily suspended, practically, because we've got the temporary full expensing measure in place at the moment until June of 2022, and shortly to be until June of 2023. But from 1 July 2023, unless there is any further legislative change, the threshold will revert to $1,000 for small business entities, that is under $10 million of aggregated turnover. Please also note that the date the asset is first acquired or first held is sometimes different to the date that the asset is first used or first installed ready for use. And you can see in this table that that can make a difference, particularly with the dates as to which measure you're under, and of course, whether the asset is fully installed before the conclusion of the particular program. So please bear in mind that to use the full expensing measure, the asset will need to be acquired and first used or installed ready for use by 30 June of 2023, otherwise it will not be eligible for this write-off. So to repeat, this bill is before the House of Representatives. It may well move through the Senate during the final sittings of Parliament for this year, and they conclude on Thursday, the 2nd of December. If the bill does not clear Parliament this year, then Parliament will be adjourned until February, and presumably debate on the bill would resume early in the new year. On to something a little bit different, because I don't often talk about state tax issues, but this particular measure is very worthy of some formal remarks. This particular piece of legislation is a Victorian bill. The Victorian Windfall Gains Tax and State Taxation and Other Acts Further Amendment Bill of 2021. The status of this bill is that it cleared the Victorian Parliament yesterday. It has now been passed by both houses of the Victorian Parliament. So that means the bill formally awaits royal assent. And the main focus of this bill is the new windfall gains tax. This will impose from 1 July 2023 a windfall gains tax on the increase in the value of land that results from a rezoning. So let's say you're a landowner and you've held onto the land for some time and it becomes rezoned for residential development. You would ordinarily expect to see a significant increase in the value of that land. Now, of course, there would be either capital gains tax on the eventual sale, but much more likely if you're developing the land yourself, it would ordinarily be a profit-making undertaking and assessable on revenue account, or even more likely, you're a property developer, and of course you would hold the land as trading stock in the course of your land development business. But this is not about federal tax law. This is about the Victorian government that will now be imposing a windfall gains tax on the unrealised gain that results from the rezoning of certain land. Now, it will apply when what is referred to as the taxable value uplift of all the rezoned land owned by that landowner or that group is above $100,000. The taxable value uplift is calculated as the difference between the capital improved value measured before and after the rezoning, less certain deductions. Now, the former value, that is the value before the rezoning, is drawn from the most recent valuation in force for the land under the Valuation of Land Act 1960 in Victoria. Whereas the latter value, the value after the rezoning, is determined through a supplementary valuation certified by the Valuer General in Victoria. So that's all a mouthful, but basically if your land goes up in value more than $100,000, then you will be subject to this new windfall gains tax. Now, the rate of tax will be 62.5% where the taxable value uplift is more than $100,000, but less than $500,000. And that rate of 62.5% will apply to that part of the taxable value uplift that exceeds $100,000. So, for example, if it was a $200,000 uplift, then we ignore the first $100,000 and we would therefore pay $62,500 of windfall gains tax in respect of that increase in value of $200,000. If, however, the taxable value uplift is $500,000 or more, then the rate of tax is a flat 50% of the whole taxable value uplift. Grouping and aggregation rules do apply, so that the $100,000 threshold applies only once to properties that are owned by the same owner or by the same group of owners and that are rezoned under the same planning scheme amendment. Some further observations about the windfall gains tax. Firstly, there is also an exemption of up to 2 hectares, so that's consistent with the adjacent rule that we have, or adjacent landfall that we have for, of course, federal capital gains tax. But we have up to 2 hectares that can be exempt of residential land. This does include primary production land where there's a residence on it, and also certain land owned by charities is excluded. Next, there are transitional arrangements available for certain contracts, option arrangements, and proponent-led rezonings that are underway when the windfall gains tax was announced, which was on the 15th of May of this year. Further, thankfully, and following some advocacy efforts by the Tax Institute and other bodies, there has been an amendment to the legislation from the original proposal so that you'll be able to defer up to 100% of the windfall gains tax for up to 30 years or until a dutiable transaction in respect of the land or the relevant acquisition occurs, whichever occurs first. So, of course, ordinarily, if there is a gain inherent in a property, you wouldn't pay income tax or capital gains tax on that profit until a CGT event happens, or of course the amount becomes assessable income because the property is sold. But the way this legislation was originally designed, you could have become liable for the windfall gains tax by having the unrealized gain happen on the rezoning, even if you had not yet realized the property. And that of course would lead to significant cash flow problems, because where are you going to get the cash from to pay the tax? So this is a sensible measure where you can defer up to all of the windfall gains tax, but effectively is the shorter of when you have a dutiable transaction arise or 30 years. And I wouldn't have thought there'd be too many dutiable transactions going beyond 30 years, most would be within. So in most cases, we'd expect to see this being deferred until duty is payable on the property. Finally, I wanted to make another observation about whether or not we can capture this windfall gains tax for federal tax purposes, either as a deduction or in the cost base of the property. Now, if we're talking property developers who are undertaking this as part of their development business, then you would expect, like any other cost they incur in the development, it would simply be a deductible amount or ultimately built into the costs of the profit that they're calculating when they sell it. But if we're talking trading stock, then it would simply be a cost and it would be able to be deducted. If, however, we're talking a property that is held on capital account, there are increasing discussions about whether or not this could go into the cost base of the property for CGT purposes. Now, we're not talking insignificant dollars. And there's been some talk that this may go into the fourth element of cost base, which is the one where costs are incurred to increase or preserve the value of the asset. Now, there is no question that the tax is payable because the property has increased in value. What I'm struggling with is that fourth element is about a cost you incur to increase or preserve the value of the asset. The tax itself does not increase or preserve the value of the asset. It's payable because the asset's value has increased. And I regard that as different. So I wouldn't have thought that you could include the windfall gains tax in the fourth element of cost base. Could it go into the third element? Now, I think this is worthy of some further consideration. When you look at third element, which is costs of holding the CGT asset, it does have a list of expenses such as interest, insurance, rates, and land tax, for example. Now, land tax is not actually defined, but I would have thought it takes its ordinary meaning, so land tax that is payable under state law. And I don't think we could describe the windfall gains tax as a land tax. When you look at section 11025, subsection 4, which lists the types of expenses that can be included in the third element of cost base, it says includes. It's not an exhaustive list. And when that provision, section 11025, subsection 4, was introduced way back many decades ago, of course, the federal government wasn't contemplating that Victoria would have a windfall gains tax commencing from 2023. So it's an interesting question as to whether this could fall into the third element of cost base. I think it is arguable, but we'd also be keen to ultimately seek an opinion from the ATO, a position, once this legislation is formally enacted. Now, as I've said, it has cleared Parliament. We are waiting for royal assent. So I think it is something that does warrant further conversation. It also has this interesting impact that the Victorian government is now going to be taxing part of effectively the growth in the property in Victoria. And it's based on unrealised gains, of course. If indeed the windfall gains tax can be included in the cost base of the property for CGT purposes, then that will reduce the capital gain and therefore the capital gains tax revenue that the federal government ultimately collects. So you can see a little bit of tension between the state and the federal governments here in respect of how this is designed, but we do need to confirm how this windfall gains tax will be treated for both income tax and for capital gains tax purposes. So on to the recent High Court decision in Addy. Now, it's not often we get tax cases coming out of the High Court. We typically see perhaps one or two a year. This one in particular deals with a backpacker called Catherine Addy. Now, Catherine was from the United Kingdom. She arrived in Australia on the 20th of August, 2015, on a subclass 417 working holiday maker visa. There are two types of working holiday maker visas, a 417 and a 462. Now, without diving into deep detail about the history of the backpacker tax, essentially it was introduced a number of years ago to deal politically with the taxation of backpackers who come to Australia, typically work in hospitality or agriculture, so fruit picking around the country, to fund their working holidays. Now, the issue is that they are typically treated as non-residents for tax purposes. And that, of course, means that given the levels of income that these people typically derive, they would be subject to a 32.5% tax rate. And this was proving unpalatable for these backpackers who were starting to consider alternative countries to take their working dollars to. And so after 2 years of a frantic debate in the Parliament on the issue, the final landing position is the working holiday maker tax. Now, more specifically, it's dealt with in part three of Schedule 7 to the Income Tax Rates Act of 1986. And these schedules impose a tax of 15% on the first $37,000 of taxable income of backpackers, which in most cases covers what they're making. Now, in most cases, they would only be earning $10,000 to $20,000 for the year at most. And so the issue in this particular case was that she arrived in Australia, as I said, in 2015. Her intention was to live and work here for the full period of her visa. And this was a period that exceeded 12 months. Now, she returned to the United Kingdom on the 1st of May 2017, so just short of 2 years later. The issue with the backpack attacks is that for most backpackers, it works much better than being taxed as a non-resident. So in other words, they can be taxed at 15% rather than the non-resident tax rate of 32.5%. But if we compare a working holiday maker being taxed at 15% to an ordinary Australian tax resident, there is a fundamental difference in that the Australian tax resident is of course eligible for the tax-free threshold. So while the backpacker tax at 15% may sound attractive, they are paying that from their first dollar. Whereas if they earned, say, $15,000 as an Australian resident, that would be completely tax-free. Now, in this particular case, the taxpayer, Addy, had derived income of just over $26,000, working in casual employment as a food and beverage waiter in Sydney. Now, if she had been a full ordinary resident of Australia, that wouldn't have been completely tax-free, of course, but with the tax-free threshold and the low income tax offset, there would have been very little tax payable. Whereas taxed as a backpacker, she was subject to 15% tax by the Commissioner on the whole of her taxable income. So the issue here is that she was essentially disputing that she should be entitled to the tax-free threshold on the basis that she is a resident of Australia. Now, while the Commissioner originally assessed her as a non-resident, but at the working holiday maker rate of 15%, the Commissioner later conceded that in fact she was a resident under the 183-day test. Now, that was because she was in Australia for more than 183 days. But the second part of that test is, do you have a usual place of abode outside Australia? And given the unique facts of this taxpayer, she actually had set herself up with rental accommodation in Sydney. She effectively had a base here, and her usual place of abode was considered to be in Australia and not the United Kingdom. Now, that will not be the case for most backpackers. They're normally living in hostels, they move around, they have no fixed base. But in this case, Addy did have a usual place of abode in Australia, and because she was here for more than 6 months, she was considered to be an Australian tax resident. So why did this case ultimately go to the High Court? The Commissioner was adamant that as a working holiday maker, she should still be taxed at the 15% tax rate with no tax-free threshold. Addy argued that she had been discriminated against under the double tax agreement between Australia and the UK. Now, let's pull this apart and unpack it a bit more. When we look at the tax rates that are applicable for backpackers, it's also, of course, subject to the double tax agreement. And there is an agreement between Australia and the UK, specifically, Article 25 of that agreement is designed to provide an anti-discrimination clause that provides protection to ensure that there is not a more burdensome taxation for someone who is a national of the United Kingdom than would have been imposed had they been an Australian national in the same circumstances. So in other words, she's saying she's been discriminated against because as a UK national, she's subject to the backpacker tax, whereas had she earned the same income in Australia as an Australian tax resident, she would have got the tax-free threshold. Now, the Commissioner argued that she had not been discriminated against and therefore the Commissioner had not contravened Section 25 of the Double Tax Agreement because the purpose of that article was to ensure that there is differential taxation imposed by reason of nationality. Now, the Commissioner was saying, you weren't discriminated against because of your nationality, you were discriminated against because you held the certain subclass visa 417. So off to the High Court we go, and this was a test case, so funded by the Commissioner. Again, it was accepted that she was a resident of Australia. The issue was whether the tax burden imposed by the backpacker tax was higher for her due to her nationality in contravention of Section 25 of the Double Tax Treaty with the UK. Now, the High Court held that a comparison is required between a UK resident and an Australian tax resident in exactly the same circumstances other than a nationality. And when you compare to the tax treatment of those earnings from exactly the same source, it is clear that an Australian tax resident would be taxed at lower rates than what Ms. Addy was taxed at. The tax rate was more onerous for her than it would be for an Australian tax resident in the same circumstances. On that basis, she had been discriminated against. Section 25 had been contravened, and on that basis, the taxpayer won her case. Now, what is the implication of this decision? Well, firstly, it's a win for the taxpayer. She does get taxed as an Australian tax resident, and she gets her tax-free threshold. But it doesn't automatically mean that every backpacker in Australia is suddenly now treated as a tax resident and gets the tax-free threshold. For two reasons, this decision is confined to a smaller group of backpackers. Firstly, they would need to be residents of Australia, and that turns on the facts. As I said earlier, most backpackers who come to Australia are not tax residents. But for those who are, they would still need to be a national or a citizen of Chile, Finland, Japan, Norway, Turkey, the UK, Germany, and Israel only. Because this anti-discrimination clause, the effective equivalent of Article 25 in the UK Double Tax Treaty, is replicated only in those 8 double tax treaties. So there are about 9 altogether where this is going to be relevant. If you're not a backpacker, and if you're not a resident, and if you're not a national of one of those countries that I listed, then this case will have no benefit for you. What will be interesting moving forward is the extent to which the government is looking at how future double tax treaties should be negotiated. And of course, the effect of the inclusion or exclusion of this anti-discrimination clause in those agreements. But certainly a setback for the government and a win for the taxpayer on this one. On to some ATO guidance, which has come out in the form of an updated PCG, a Practical Compliance Guideline 2020/3. I mentioned this in last month's Tax Insights, but we didn't formally have the expanded ATO guidance. So this is about the shortcut method for employees who have been working from home since the beginning of the COVID pandemic. We know that the shortcut method, or 80 cents per hour, has been available from 1 March 2020 to 30 June 2020. That was the initial position of the ATO. Then it was extended for a further income year, the whole of 2021. And now the ATO has formally extended this to the whole of 21-22. So that means that any employee who is required to work from home may use the shortcut method to claim those working from home expenses. As an alternative to either the fixed rate method at 52 cents an hour or the actual cost method, which is generally much more difficult to calculate, particularly when it comes to heating and cooling and electricity usage and so on. Now, the key difference between the shortcut method and the 52 cents an hour, apart from the obvious being different rates, is that more things are included in the shortcut method. For example, mobile telephone and data internet connections are included, whereas they're excluded specifically from the fixed rate method. Also, with the fixed rate method, you need a dedicated workspace. Whereas with the shortcut method, this very sensibly has allowed flexibility, so you can do it from your kitchen bench, your dining room table, or indeed your lounge suite. So it's great that this has been extended through to June of 2022. But of course, you do need to keep accurate records. So while we may not have had the certainty until recently that this has been available through to June next year, you may need to go back and have a look at what sort of records you've maintained since July this year in order to put through a valid claim, but you will need some sort of record like a diary or timesheets or some sort of roster. The ATO is also looking to modernise the 52 cents an hour from 22-23. Now, what is apparent is that the idea of working from home, which has certainly been a necessity, and we couldn't have functioned in our workplaces without that flexibility of working from home over the past 20-odd months. But I think this will be one of the legacies of COVID, that even with offices now reopening, you may find that where someone once used to work from home once a week or once a fortnight, they may now choose to work from home for 4 or even 5 days a week and go into the office only once a week or once a fortnight. So the complete reversal. So it is going to be necessary for the ATO to turn its mind to beyond the end of next financial year. So in other words, when we're looking 1 July 2022 onwards, what sort of claims can we make and how will that work when we've got working from home as being the norm for millions of workers across the country? The Tax Institute certainly welcomes the extension of the shortcut method through to June next year, but we would also welcome serious consideration being given to some sensible method that is more generous than 52 cents an hour, provides more flexibility, and acknowledges those of us who are working from home and may continue to do so for some time. So that brings the Tax Insights program to a close for 2021. And as we move into this festive season, and I must have inadvertently dressed for it today with my red jacket, but it's been a big year and a long year. The profession is tired, and certainly you have absolutely stepped up this year to look after clients and the community and taxpayers across the country. Thank you for it, as we do at the Tax Institute. On behalf of all of the staff at the Tax Institute, we wish you a safe and a relaxing festive break. We look forward to bringing Tax Insights to you again early in the new year. Have a wonderful break, and we'll see you next year.
Thanks, Robin, for your presentation. We trust today's insights have provided you with a valuable update. The Tax Institute is committed to providing members with timely and relevant content, and we look forward to engaging with you again next month.